And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Do you remember the number?
I don't have enough fingers and toes.
I think it's 30, isn't it?
It's the big three.
Yeah. Wow. 3-0.
I thought it was 3-1.
No, 3-0.
It's 3-0. Wow.
3-0, yeah.
This show is now old enough for me to flirt with it. It's awesome.
That's going in the highlights reel. Mm-hmm. That is going in the highlights reel. This is Chatter on Books. We are at the corner of Wisconsin, the rainy corner of Jennifer Streets and Wisconsin Avenues Northwest at Chatter. And Michael is on assignment with his father somewhere. North Carolina?
Mm-hmm. On the back nine.
Yeah, on the back nine.
One of the Carolinas.
Good, with lots of news to come back. But we have Jeannie and Mark and David Aldridge, and we've got quite a few things on tap for this evening. We have a little news from our dear friends at Calvert Woodley, and Michael Sands and Steve Sands, Ed Sands, lost their mom and their wife this weekend, which is very, very sad.
Very sad.
We send our best to all of them, just dear, dear, wonderful people. They're closing down Calvert Woodley tomorrow, I guess, for a service for her, and I think it's probably the first time in forever that they've ever shut that place down. Because I know they stayed open through Snowmageddon.
Yeah.
So
they were delivering during Snowmageddon.
They did very, very nicely. Jen sent us today, because we have on later Susan Swain and Brian Lamb, who are going to talk about their great book, The Presidents. Jen pulled for us from the Barboursville Vineyard in Virginia a Cabernet Franc Reserve 2016. And this is from the Barboursville Vineyard, which has an amazing story. I'm probably the only one here who's been there. Have you been there, Jeannie?
I have not been there.
Yeah, David. No. Really. Got to go across a river. It is lovely. The house was designed by Thomas Jefferson for his friend James Barber. Brian and Susan will correct everything I've said when they come up here, I'm sure. But he designed the house for his friend James Barber, who went on to be a governor of Virginia and I believe a secretary of war at one point. Okay. And Jefferson always wanted to have vineyards. He thought Virginia was a great place. He never quite got it figured out. But in 1976, an Italian family with a lot of experience came over to Virginia and settled there and started producing this wine, which evidently now is considered really, really good. But Jeannie and David,
you're trying.
What do you think?
It was very good.
Jefferson was a wine buff.
My glass is empty.
Yeah, he was a wine buff.
He was not in France.
He was not a successful wine buff, however, right?
And
so
buff.
What does
expert.
What does it taste like? And I'll see if it tells you what the bottle says it tastes like.
I'm so bad with these wine.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, we need Michael.
It tastes good.
Like, tastes like victory.
But it's very good. It tastes like victory. We have a lovely cheese also from Virginia. Ibrahim pulled a great cheese, Meadow Creek. Which is from Galax, Virginia. I've never heard of Galax, Virginia. G-A-L-A-X, Virginia. Never heard of it.
I have no idea where Galax,
but it's lovely.
Virginia is.
Yeah, it's lovely. We also have a little news. Ms. McManus, you have a show coming up.
Yes, I have an art show coming up. It begins July 5th.
Excellent day
reception.
For an art show.
Yes, so many people are in town on July 5th. I think they chose this for me and Sarah Maddox, the other artist, because it's such a high point of the summer. Anyway, it is at Glen Echo. It is in the Parkview Gallery, which is in the main building of Glen Echo, but on the second story. So you have to wander around a little bit to find it. Opening reception is 6 to 8, July 5th, but it's hanging from July 5th to July 27th.
Which is good, because some of us would very much like to be there, but we might be out of town.
So if you're just wandering around some hot summer day and need something to do, go
so
drop by.
So what happens if people come through and see this wonderful art and they want it? Can they buy it on the spot and it comes off the walls?
They can buy it on the spot. They can't take it off the wall. They can take it off the wall when the show comes down.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
And no, I can't sell you something in advance. Somebody has already asked me.
Wow.
No, you have to go to the show, and we have to keep it up on the wall.
Okay. Well, we'll encourage people to go.
I'm going to go and buy an original McManus. I love this. Exactly.
Can I commission, like badgers playing poker?
No, I do not do commissions, okay? Let me just play that straight.
I can't remember his name, but... Oh, wait, no, I do remember his name, but I won't say it. There was a very, very senior official in the Baker State Department. Mm-hmm. And when you're a very, very senior person in some of these places, you get to choose artwork to go on your walls that are in the collection that never gets made. Mm-hmm. And so usually people pick something that is of historical significance, or they really like Thomas Jefferson. So and this person, swear to God, dogs playing poker.
Ah! Oh, that's brilliant.
Was it Velvet?
And didn't even think it was
See
funny.
See that Velvet? You got to pay extra for that.
Didn't even think it was funny.
I hope he was not making critical decisions about the United States
he
of
was.
America.
Oh, he was. Boy. He was considered a good poker player. Okay. We have a little book club therapy to dispense.
Oh, good.
And in Deserted Island, I really wish Michael were here, but since there are so many babies born in the summer, evidently the most in August, but sometimes more in June or July, books for expecting parents. Mark's already laughing. Okay, book club therapy. This is a good one. Hold on. Oh, wait, I have to do Judith Krantz first.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Happy Trails, because we do nothing but steal on this show, so we're stealing the Happy Trails line. Absolutely. Judith Krantz, who sold millions and millions millions of her books, died at 91 in Los Angeles. She didn't publish her first book until she was 50.
How about that?
The Obit in the New York Times by Marguerite Fox is spectacular because I'm going to read a little bit of this. What drove Ms. Krantz's books to the tops of bestseller lists time and time again was a formula that she honed to glittering perfection. Fevered horizontal activities combined with fevered vertical ones. The former taking place in sumptuously appointed bedrooms and five-star hotels, the latter anywhere with a cash register and astronomical price tags. And then a line or two from her second novel, Princess Daisy, 1980. Recklessly, she flung... We need some music for this. Recklessly, she flung herself out of her clouds of chiffon plumage, only to appear in her resplendent flesh, lying totally naked on a pile of horse blankets, laughing softly as she watched, wait for it, Stash Valensky.
Stash?
Momentarily bewildered and taken by surprise, struggled out of his dinner jacket. Nothing better.
I went to high school with a guy named nicknamed Stash.
Stash Valensky.
You can't make that up.
No. I really recommend the obituary of the New York Times. She came from a very well-off family, very well-educated, went to Wellesley. I love it, though. Now nobody knows Wellesley. They have to say Wellesley, a school in Massachusetts. And people criticized her for writing these steamy, foil-covered romance novels. And she just says, I do the best job I can. And she made a fortune,
she
so good for her.
Gobs
she
did. Cash.
Yeah. Okay. So, book club therapy. Who's not read one of our book club therapy emails?
I don't think I
Who's
have.
Who's not done a reading? Have you done a reading, Mark?
No, I don't believe I have.
Well, you're right. Boys.
Dramatic
you can do this
reading.
One.
All right. Please.
Get ready, Jeannie and David.
Do a little Bobby Duvall if you want. That's
I just love this.
That would be good.
Napalm.
I never thought this would happen to me.
No.
Hi, to Chatter on Books. I belong to a men's book club.
There you go.
A couple of us started it years ago because we found ourselves over lunch talking about the books we read and decided we should just read the same books. We read almost only nonfiction, and that's the problem. A book by McCullough or David Marinus, no problem. We're Washington hacks and can do that scene. Once in a while we read a novel, but we're such idiots the conversation about it is terrible. Please help. What is some fiction we can read that isn't Nicholas Sparks or Danielle Steele? No offense intended to readers of their books, by the way. And we scratched out his name, but his real name is Bob Smith.
From Reston. Jeannie?
Well, the first one that comes to mind, and I've mentioned it before on the show, is The Sun by Philip Meyer, which is this sweeping saga of a Texas family, about five generations of a Texas family. Now, it is extremely violent, and that's not to stereotype this men's book club.
But you just did.
But I did love the book myself. So there's lots of warring factions, and again, I am stereotyping you, but if you don't want Nicholas Sparks, this seems to me a good counterpoint to that.
David?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, start with, these are big books, but you know, Winds of War or something like that.
Dove. Lonesome Dove would be a good one.
Excellent.
Yeah. Larry McMurtry books. Something like, yes, that would be it. That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Or let me just put a vote in, because you guys know I love it, for historical fiction. You know,
if you're the ones Patrick...
Patrick O'Brien.
Oh, no,
those, but I'm thinking more of the Michael Schorr, you know, like the Killer Angels and stuff like that.
Okay.
So or Hilary Mantle, Bringing Up the Bones, those historical fiction.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's lots of good stuff out there.
And, you know, I totally get what you're saying about not wanting Nicholas Sparks.
And you don't have to go nuts about you know, the quality. And I'm not damning with faint praise. But, you know, John Grisham writes very entertaining novels.
Yeah.
He writes very good books.
And this will sound sort of in that vein, but, you know, and it's not for everybody, but you get involved in a great Stephen King novel,
sure,
and you cannot put it down.
Yes, yes.
And then when the lights go out,
right.
You know, after reading it, I couldn't have my shower curtain closed for like a month.
You're there you
like,
go.
No.
So those are
you know what?
Oh,
they should start with Lonesome Dove. I think that's a great idea.
That's a really good one.
It's so beautifully written.
Start with Cowboys.
Yeah. So it's good. Excellent. Okay, so if you have book club therapy, or you need book club therapy, you send your completely confidential complaints, angst to Tori at chatteronbooks.com, and we will answer them.
I would never get in a book club. This would never do.
Who needs to join something else?
Exactly.
Who needs to join something else?
I want people knowing what I'm reading.
All right, so last week we ran out of time, but we were going to spin off this article that appeared that Jeannie sent to me.
Oh, right.
It says book readers, because you think of book readers and you think it's a solitary process and you're by yourself in your own little world, but this study from Kingston University in London, Jeannie, I think it was, says that readers are more empathetic and more social than non-readers. Agree or disagree?
I just don't think you can make that sweeping statement about book readers.
Well, their study was only 123 people, but what the heck?
Yeah, that is a small and somewhat random sample, I'm guessing. But they might possibly be more empathetic than people who spend their time playing violent
video games.
Mm-hmm. I'm just guessing there. Again, I don't have a study to support that statement. But we encourage reading, and if it makes you more empathetic,
So I did a little research, and there was an article in Scientific American, which is somewhat reputable, 2013, that had its own thing saying readers are more empathetic and more social and basically nicer people than non-readers, and actually went on to say that literary fiction readers are more empathetic than your genre fiction.
So
if you're a romance or a mystery novel person, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
But true literary fiction, then you're going to be more empathetic. I disagree completely. Because fiction, it's aspirational. It's what people want in someone, good, bad, or otherwise, versus nonfiction, it's the real deal.
Right.
It's the real deal.
So archetypes in fiction.
Yeah, and this all goes back to my sisters. David knows I'm going to write the book one of these days.
I love this idea.
King Lear crossed with 23andMe. They read
Someone laughed out loud. Someone actually guffawed out there.
All four of them read a ton when they were young, a ton, and it was all fiction. And they all grew up thinking that they were going to have the lives.
Yeah.
Like some of the many, many people they read about in fiction.
Right.
Dream world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
unhealthy. You would like to think that reading about maybe other people and other cultures might make you somewhat empathetic. I share your pessimism that it actually sinks in.
Again, the study of 123 people.
Also, think of the classic definition of a bookworm is somebody who is sitting in a corner by herself, right, not relating to the rest of the world, just curled up, isolated from everybody else.
And I actually use them as that's my me time, right?
Yeah.
I'm sitting down with my book and leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, plug for next week, Angie Kim and this book, Miracle Creek. Holy cow.
Oh, can't wait.
Holy cow.
Okay.
Really amazing. An amazing person.
Yeah.
Okay. So where were we? I'm against. I say they're less empathetic.
I would tend to agree with you. I don't know that they are less empathetic. I don't know that they are any more empathetic than
Jeannie?
Normal.
I would say it's a stupid study and I don't
Good.
Pay any
Perfect.
Attention to it.
Yeah. For just 120, if there's 124 people that they checked out, I buy into
exactly.
it. But it's just below that threshold.
And don't go to Kingston University, which we've never heard of.
But it's in Ontario.
It's Canada. It's Canada.
They're always nice up there.
We sure that's not Jamaica?
That's a good point.
I tell you what.
You got to be more empathetic.
I love Canadians.
Okay, we are very empathetically going to take a break here, and then we will come back with Susan Swain and Brian Lamb to talk about this fabulous book,
it
The
is
Presidents.
So interesting,
fabulous.
Yes.
We are back. Chatter on Books on a lovely rainy day here on the corner of Wisconsin Jennifer Streets. And we are absolutely, absolutely thrilled to have Susan Swain and Brian Lamb of C-SPAN with us. And they've done incredible things at C-SPAN over the last, 800 years, Brian?
I think so.
This book, The Presidents, is really, really something. And it's really something for C-SPAN, which I want to get to. But first, in classic Brian Lamb tradition, So many people in this town, so many people in this country, I'm guessing in the world, know both of you, and they feel as though they know you really well. Yes, they feel like they're you're their best friends. They probably don't know the backstories. So Susan first, where are you from? Where'd you grow up? What did you want to be when you're five? What's kept you at C-SPAN? And then we'll do Brian. You're both kind of Heartland kids.
I'm not. I'm from Philadelphia.
Well, that's okay.
The Heartland.
Heartland.
215.
215 area code. Yeah, close, Tori. Okay. Grew up in the burbs of Philadelphia. Went to Catholic school all my life. Went
you
to,
and Jeannie.
Yeah. Went to Catholic grade school and then Bishop McDevitt High School in Philadelphia.
Are you a good speller?
I was.
Catholic school kids are always good spellers.
And my cursive handwriting.
Yeah, right. Same here.
Yeah, and then I went on to a Jesuit school in Pennsylvania, University of Scranton.
So you're very organized.
Lovely.
What else do you want to know? Uh-huh. I came to C-SPAN about 3 years out of college.
How did you find C-SPAN, or how did they find you?
Well, I moved, like everybody, I moved to Washington because I thought Washington was waiting for me, and Washington was not waiting for me. And I spent 11 months renting a room and interviewing for every job in the world. And I actually was offered a job on Capitol Hill as an assistant press secretary to a congressman who was retiring in 6 months. It was not going to be a very long-lasting career. But very nicely, Bill Fleming, the press secretary, called me at home and said, I'm going to offer you this job, but I hope you say no, because my wife works for this small television network that just got started called C-SPAN, and I think you'd be a great fit. So as I tell the story, I walked into Brian's office the next day with my shoes shined and all ready to go, and he just never could get rid of me all these years later.
What's kept you there this long?
Well, we were a group of 25-year-olds and Brian, who was just a little older.
I was 27.
Yeah, right. Completely reinventing sort of television models. We were doing television the way it used to be done in the very early days by gavel-to-gavel coverage and live and no commentary at a time when everybody was saying, who would watch that stuff? And it was really exciting for us to be part of startup at that point and to get to build this place. And really, everybody that built it, many of those folks are still working with us. And we engineered every single bit of C-SPAN, from something that was on satellite for 6 hours a day to now three networks, radio station, traveling bus around the country, lots of podcasts of our own. And it's just been a great ride. And the thing about it is it puts you in the center of everything that's going on. And why would you leave when you have that opportunity?
Yeah. Brian?
Tori.
He gets to work with me. That's what
he asked. It's very exciting.
Hey, before he answers,
Indiana,
can I ask one
right?
question?
Yes,
is
of
this
course.
The first person that's ever come here in a suit and tie to do the podcast?
No, we've had a couple suits.
We've had a couple suits and ties. Yeah. They were on their way to funerals. So they just stopped by for a little chat before they went. Or job interviews. That's the only reason people show up in suit and ties in this town. Job interview or a funeral.
We've discovered Brian has worn at least one pair of jeans to a company event, but it has a white line down the front. We're being impressed.
So brutal.
We're going to have a whole show, just abuse Brian and I. Indiana, right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, sitting here with you and this podcast reminds me of how I started in all this business, because the independence you have is so magnificent. I started at a tiny little radio station in Lafayette, Indiana, when I was about 13.
Did you do the news? What did you do?
No, I was pressed my nose against the glass and said, let me in, and ended up filing records, and then gave a station break one day, and then a 30-minute disc jockey show, and it's the story of most people in this business.
What kind of music did you play?
Everything. Even on Sunday nights, because Purdue is there, and that's where I went to school, I used to read poetry to the
on air?
Yeah, but I was copying off of a guy.
Did you wear a little beret when you did it?
No, but you know, you always, when you start out in this business, you copy others.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who's reading poetry on air?
Franklin McCormick.
How about that?
Wow.
He would say, the torch is burning.
Oh, my God. Oh, it's too bad Michael Kornheiser's not here tonight. He loves poetry. He can do poetry slams.
I love you.
I
love you. I love you.
You know Jim Stavridis, former retired admiral, great guy, fabulous guy.
Sure.
Great talker.
Yes,
one of our all-time best guests. He and Mike, I don't even know how we got onto that night, but he and Michael were slamming lines of poetry at one another.
It's very
pretty
impressive.
Remarkable. So, Indiana, you were at the Pentagon. You were a public
Navy.
Affairs guy.
I spent
guy.
4 years in the Navy. Ended up at the Pentagon for 2 years. Should have had the job that you once got, but nobody cared. I was only a O2.
Oh, please. Wouldn't have even talked to you.
They didn't.
<It's> true.
It was a great learning experience.
Did you work on one of the news desks? You've told me this, and I forgot.
Well, I was in the audiovisual section.
Right.
You know, I was one of those that picked up the phone, and I remember Bill Small from CBS, who was a great journalist, would call and say, we want McNamara on Sunday on Face the Nation. And I said, Bill, and I was somewhat intimidated by him at the time. He was a tough guy. I said, Bill, you know that's not going to happen, but I appreciate you asking. McNamara never appeared on any of the Sunday shows until he quit.
Smart man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of return on investment on that for him. So Pentagon, and then I know the C-SPAN story, but I'm just a huge C-SPAN junkie and such a fan of what it is and know how it all started. But I bet if you grab 15 people off the street right now, 14 and a half of them would say, oh, it's, you know, so-and-so produces that or the networks produce that or whatever. They don't know how C-SPAN got started, Ryan.
Or they would say that's either that government channel that the government owns or it's Ted Turner's.
Yeah.
Is that right?
No. 40 years of it.
Really?
Resentment there.
No, because it's just we're two different animals, to say the least.
Yeah, say the least.
No, I never mind.
I worked for Mr. Turner's network at one point in my life. So
well, he did a great thing. We actually beat him by about 18 months.
Is that right?
In the business, yeah. But anyway, I started with four people. Susan came right after that. I mean, Susan's been with us.
2 years, actually.
Yeah, 2 years after that. We started televising the House of Representatives.
But how did you convince the cable executives? It's a service of the cable TV industry. I still call it the cable TV industry.
Yeah.
But how did you convince them to do it?
I didn't. I actually made a presentation in front of about 40 cable operators, and one of the most outstanding persons I've ever met in business, Bob Rosenkranz, was in the audience, and he came up to me afterwards and said, I kind of like what you're suggesting that we do. And it was all because of Bob. And then we started adding people that you've known, Ralph Baruch and Russell Karp and all these people in the cable business. But really, Bob was the guy who they loved. They thought he was a terrific guy. And they didn't know me, and I wasn't a business guy. And they basically said, if Bob thinks this is okay, we'll give it a try.
How much did it cost back then?
Our first year, about $450,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And four people. I mean, it was a tiny little place.
Wow.
It evolved step by step by step. And frankly, if you're going to give credit to anybody besides all these cable guys that put us on their systems, give credit to the public at large, because they are the ones that started watching and reacting.
Mm-hmm.
And as they did that, everybody started listening to the fact that somebody would actually pay attention to this stuff.
You know what? I'm a huge fan of transparency, and I think everything and anything the government does, with very few exceptions, should be made available via television, via radio, via everything. So, huge fan of that.
If we could just get a camera in the Supreme Court, I would be extremely happy.
Push that button on Brian Lamb. Go.
It won't happen with this crowd. This group is there now, the nine.
But why should it?
There are only 75 hours a year that you would be able to see. Anyway.
I would watch every minute.
And it does not do any damage at all whatsoever to them or the court.
Sure, right. Of course.
The chief has the gavel. The chief can determine what goes on in there. Mm-hmm. They just don't want to do it.
Because?
They give you different reasons, everything from security to they're not television stars. Although Ruth Bader Ginsburg heads up to New York and appears on those late night shows all the time. I can go on and on. They just don't want to do it because they don't like what television does to other institutions, and they don't want to take the chance that it'll do the same thing to theirs. That's what they say.
How do you answer the critics that say C-SPAN has turned members of Congress into media hounds?
Probably some of that has happened. I mean, it seems to me these are grown people.
The members of Congress? Yeah, sort of.
They were elected by their constituency, and they are adults, and they ought to be able to, you know, perform in public without being crazy. But we all know what we've seen over the years, and I don't think it matters whether we're there or not. They would have done it somewhere else. I don't really care if they criticize us. We did what we did. It's an open process, and we've not tampered with it. And you see exactly what happens as it happens.
Yeah.
And, And we do it on a relatively small budget of about $65 million a year.
That's amazing. That's incredible. I think it's more powerful than ever in an age and a day in which technology can so overproduce everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What you see is what you get.
Right.
Might not like it, might love it, not, whatever. So, Susan, I want to turn to you so we can turn to the book, because 40th anniversary of C-SPAN caused you all to think about this particular book. And as you and I were talking before the show, if you hang out with all the sports guys, you're always ranking. You're always, you know, was Babe Ruth better than this one? It's always ranking. It's who's better? Who's worse? This is how they spend.
Sandy Koufax.
One of the pitfalls of the profession. Yeah. Yes.
And if you put these two guys on the same team with this guy, but this one was a dinosaur, so whatever. So, but rankings. C-SPAN is so we don't have opinions. C-SPAN is what you see is what you get. This gets into something that isn't particularly C-SPAN's philosophy, ranking. But what caused you 40 years in for C-SPAN to think this was a good idea?
We've been ranking since 2000. That's for when we did the first one. And we had just finished a whole year of live programs from presidential historic sites, mm-hmm. doing biographies of the presidents. And we thought, what do we do to put some context for this? We've done all this effort, and all of a sudden it's just over. So we went to these three fabulous historians who are on the cover of the book, Edna Medford, who's here at Howard University in Washington, Douglas Brinkley, whom you all know from many appearances on television, and Richard Norton Smith, who's also frequently on television, fabulous presidential historians. And we came up with this idea of the rankings. And it's not a popularity poll per se, because these are professional observers of the presidency. And together, they crafted the 10 metrics, and we sent the first one out in 2000 when Bill Clinton was leaving office. Bill Clinton has gone up a few notches in the three surveys, and we did the second one when George W. Bush was coming out of office, and it seemed, hey, this is working for us. We're getting a lot of people talking about presidents and leadership. Mm-hmm. So we did the last one in 2017 as Barack Obama was leaving. So we have these three surveys. And we also have a fabulous library of Brian's interviews over the years with the historians. So the idea for the anniversary was merge two resources. Mm-hmm. So the book is actually, it is organized by the rankings, but the chapters are independent of. And in some cases, you find the ranking maybe conflicts with what you learn in the biography. So, again, we're causing people to think. Mm-hmm. So that's very C-SPAN-like.
It's hard for me to describe, but how the historians talk about some of these things is wonderful. They clearly care deeply.
Sure.
And some of them are so thrilled to be able to tell a story that they haven't told in the 15 books that they've written before. And they take it very, very personally, and they take criticism of their rankings of some of them very personally. But was it JFK? Hold on, I wrote this down. I think I even had the page number. It's on page one. JFK says nobody can rank presidents. Nobody can rate presidents because they don't know what it's like. They haven't been there. They don't know what the pressures are, those kinds of things. And I'm just wondering, more recent presidents, some that are still alive, any objections to the rankings over the years? Hear any grief from anybody?
We really haven't. I don't think it's best to ignore it if you don't like it, right? That would be your advice.
That's what we say on this show.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
If you don't like us, stay away.
Yeah.
What surprised you the most?
Well, it's been, I don't know that it surprised me, but it's been fun going on this book tour. Even a gentleman who is a regular at your podcast stopped us and said, if you were going to do the poll today, how would the incumbent rank? And every place we've gone, people have asked that question. And we're not going to do a survey until he leaves office, so we can't answer it empirically. But the interesting thing about it, people are so polarized about this president, for or against. But if you take the metrics, he's actually going to do pretty well in some of the categories. Mm-hmm. So he will not be in the James Buchanan territory, I would hazard to guess at this point.
Could you guys, I've read the book, I love the book, can you guys explain how anybody ends up below Harrison?
I love that, actually.
31 days?
Yeah.
Come on.
Richard Norton Smith said that makes all the other presidencies that are below him net negatives.
How bad is it you're below Harrison?
That was a question of popularity, though. I mean, he was a successful general, and that's part of what goes on in these surveys. Mm-hmm. We don't live our lives by this survey. It just is something interesting to do, and you can disagree with it. The living presidents are so used to being criticized, they don't care.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They're used to it.
There are, I have to say, though, we have experienced the fact that some living presidential libraries are not very happy with this, mm-hmm. but it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, we just avoid, just don't go there.
Don't go there. So hopefully you'll keep doing these because it's fascinating, and I'm fascinated how some people must move. So at Jackson.
Going down.
Democrat, God bless him, I'm married to one. Jefferson Jackson dinners were the big, that was what you did every year. That was your big rallying, let's get everybody right. Mm-hmm. And people are running from Jackson. Well, some aren't. But people are running from Jackson.
Down
but he's
five.
Moving. Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, they're not, it's interesting. They're not, our survey doesn't show this, but other surveys do. They're, excuse me, even running from JFK.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I could see
as,
that.
As more and more sure. becomes public
because
about the way he treated women.
Sure.
The less and less enamored some people
mm-hmm.
are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to change over time, and it should. I mean, right. although well, we try not to, in the survey, and Susan's better at this than I am, we try not in the survey to judge them only based on how we feel about them today. Mm-hmm. It's very important to know what they did back then.
Who was it somebody said? Somebody famous said, judge people in the era in which they lived.
Well,
which
sure.
For a long time, I thought, okay, that makes sense. And then the more I think about it, I go, does it really?
Well.
Does it really?
Well, we are not in the era that they lived, so we can't possibly judge them that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Harrison one, interestingly, he actually was enormously popular, and he created the modern presidential campaign, as you learn in the chapter. And people were shocked, even though he was older, that he passed away. So that 1 month, I think, was still had some a contribution to American society at the time.
Yeah.
And so that's why the ones below end up being a net negative, I think, overall.
I have to say, though, Tori, the fact that he had been governor of the Indiana Territory had something to do with his
yeah.
popularity.
Yeah.
As somebody who's from
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I can see how presidents, not modern-day presidents, would fluctuate in the rankings
sure.
because you learn more and more about them mm-hmm. as time goes on. But modern-day presidents, do we know everything? Are they pretty much now set in stone where they are in the rankings? Or does somebody mm-hmm. somebody else goes down, so that's what brings somebody else up?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Because there's a net number.
And here's a good example. Who knows where George W. Bush will end up? Mm-hmm. The war is up right at the top, and there was, you know, there's a lot of dislike for what happened. But 50 years from now, who knows what
good
that...
Good point.
I mean,
right.
it
yeah.
could, mm-hmm. it could come out a lot better than it looks today.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton was 21 right at the time of the first survey. He's now at 15 for the last two. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush went from 36 to 33rd. And what's interesting is the ones that have gone down, this reflects our changing society.
Sure.
Almost all of them have bad records on racial issues.
I was going to say, Woodrow Wilson
that
probably
wow.
going
very
to the floor
thing.
Right now.
Yeah,
right?
yeah and Grover Cleveland.
Yeah.
Here
right.
we are right by Cleveland Park.
Right.
But he had bad record on some of mm-hmm. those issues.
But I have to say, the one president that doesn't get much attention now, he did for a while, thanks to David McCullough, who is sixth in this survey and is a monumental president in our history, is Truman.
Yeah.
And people don't particularly like to talk about him because mm-hmm. he wasn't glamorous, but
right.
you examine his life, and this chapter is fantastic
yeah.
in here. It's David Herbert Donald's mm-hmm. widow mm-hmm. Who wrote the chapter. She was 82 when I interviewed her. She used to be the editor of the Harvard Press, and it's a great chapter, but Harry Truman was an incredibly yeah. interesting human being.
I think he's coming way up in most people's
it's
books.
Amazing.
Especially the
he's
time
incredible.
In
yeah.
which he served. So challenging.
And he's the last president not to have a college education.
Right.
Wow.
But you just go down the list of
yeah.
everything that, you know.
Well, Grant, you know. I didn't know Grant, speaking of 400,000 African Americans voted for Grant.
Right.
People think Obama was the first
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
popular. Grant, and Grant worked against the voter suppression efforts at the time.
Right.
I didn't know that about him.
I was also amazed at how LBJ was transformed by becoming president. I mean, he was a liar. Mm-hmm. He was a manipulator. And all of a sudden, he overnight becomes president and starts the war on poverty. I mean, it just becomes presidential.
I had the unique experience of being around him for 2 years. I was not on his staff, but I was in the Navy at the time, and I worked as a social aide,
mm-hmm.
and I spent a lot of time close to him. And I'd have to say, of any, and I've been lucky to interview a whole bunch of presidents, he has more power in his presence than almost any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But more than anything else, he knew as much about the United States Congress as anybody
right.
alive.
Yeah. Right.
That was
majority
his power.
Leader.
Right.
Anybody
he knew how to get votes.
Yeah. But I stood next to him as I did the very simple task of say, give me your name and I'll then speak it and the president will then you know, shake your hand. And so people constantly, and I'm sitting here with one ear saying, this woman says Susan Swain, and I say, Susan Swain. At the same time, I'm listening out of my left ear at everything that he's saying to people that come through there, because he used to conduct business in that. My favorite one time was when he called an aide over and he said, get the plane, I want to go to Texas. And this was during the receiving line. And within an hour, the helicopter landed on the South Lawn. Tori, you went close to this kind of thing. And he was off to Texas and went to sleep in Texas that night, and nobody had planned it. And he did that kind of stuff all the time.
It's good to be president.
I am LBJ is, to me, the most fascinating president in our history because of the incredible circumstances under which he became president. He literally went from he won't be on the ticket in 64 to president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And through that... And to your point about Kennedy, for the kind of, and I'm a history major, so thank you for talking to historians. The sense that people had about Kennedy maybe 20 years ago and the romanticism because of the assassination, I'm sure. But the fact is, John Kennedy would not have gotten the Civil Rights Act passed. Simply would not have happened. He would not have gotten the Voting Rights Act passed. Would not have happened. But for him being assassinated, LBJ became president and was able, because of his history in the Senate as the majority leader, he knew how to get things passed.
Right.
And it is fascinating to me that he became president at the exact moment where this had to happen or it was not going to happen. And it's that fascinates me. But you have all these other categories, like the Vietnam War. If I was an 18-year-old kid, I would hate LBJ. I understand that. And so I wonder how you kind of weigh those two things, those monumental decisions that he was making in real time at the same time.
Well, the person that is weighing it more than any other human being alive is Bob Carroll.
Right.
Right.
He's
right.
83 years old, and he has the last book to go, and he's about halfway done.
Right.
And he says, I don't have a timetable.
please.
Which
please
is fascinating.
Finish it.
You know, and you said he hasn't gone to Vietnam yet. Is that correct?
He has not gone to Vietnam yet. He said that, though, to me, and every time I interview him for 10 years.
Yeah.
And I keep asking him, have you been to Vietnam yet? Are you going to Vietnam? Yes, I'm going to Vietnam. And he tends to stay. He wants a couple months there at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he doesn't use a computer, right?
No, he uses a typewriter, and he has, I don't know, I think he's down to 14 of them. And he uses
so
the different,
great.
You know, he manipulates them and
so great.
Keeps them going.
I think I told the story maybe on this show or on television, I can't remember, but I was reading one of his books. They're so spectacular. And he talks about Johnson, whenever it was, campaigning in Virginia, in Culpeper, Virginia. And he spelt it C-U-L-P-E-P-P-E-R. And as somebody who spent way too much time in Culpeper, Virginia, not worth explaining, it was where the earthquake occurred. I know that it is C-U-L-P-E-P-E-R. And I thought, oh, my freaking God, I have caught Robert Caro in a mistake. So, of course, I have to go look this up. So I go to my friend at Google. And in the time in which Johnson was campaigning, Culpeper was spelt the way he put it.
What happened to their extra P?
Wow. Can't even remember. I was so depressed that I had
you
not
had nailed
thought.
It.
Okay, we could just do the whole Brian
God.
Lamb interviewing the presidents.
It's
president
so
with the most charisma. Johnson, most power. Who had the most charisma?
Mine said Kennedy, I think.
We'd have to know what it was like at the time.
Right.
I mean, it could have easily been Andrew Jackson.
Yeah. Right, but I mean, in the modern presidents.
Modern presidents?
And
modern,
I think that's what happened with the reporters. They were caught up in that charisma at the time.
I have to say, though, that if it wasn't for his dalliances, if that's the word, Bill Clinton would have been charisma.
Sure.
But there's, you know, let's face it, and it's not a question, let's face it, but Barack Obama has enormous charisma. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But Reagan had it.
Yeah. Reagan was incredible.
Yes. The actor.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
He had it. People.
I think the ones that have it, and I can only speak about the modern ones, they genuinely like people. Agree or disagree with Bill Clinton?
Him
or hate him, right?
Oh, no
he
question.
Genuinely likes people.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan wasn't as comfortable with it as people thought, but he really liked people. I once saw him in the front whatever of the White House there at a state dinner explaining to some people why he was late. And he was late because he had lost the stud off his tuxedo shirt.
Oh, that's great.
And he had to go back and get another shirt, but he didn't have the right studs in it. And he's telling the story. And I'm watching these people around him. And they were very important people. And they're just enthralled.
Mm-hmm.
And it just oozed. And he loved telling them the story. And they're all nervous. They're at a state dinner probably for the first time. And he made them all feel great about themselves, telling the story about how he popped the stud off his shirt.
Except
powerful.
did not embrace his staff particularly, right? Was rather standoffish with
children.
People close to him.
Okay. Ronald bring
Reagan.
That story.
Ronald
down.
Reagan, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I remember standing in a room with him one time, and nobody was allowed to speak, and he didn't speak, and we're all standing there looking at each other. I don't think there was a. You saw him, Tori, more than I did. We did a high school kid program with him and spent some time around him. And you couldn't break through the facade. Mm-hmm. At least I didn't see anybody. He was basically, but he looked fantastically friendly.
Yeah. He did.
Well, you tell the story of he was preparing to give a speech, and then all of a sudden the monitor goes on and he goes, oh, there he is, speaking of himself, right? And he was literally a television character. That
was sad that Edmund Morris just died. That was Edmund Morris's story.
Okay.
Where he had been allowed to be around him for 30 minutes a month and interview him for 30 minutes a month and hang around the White House anytime mm-hmm. he wanted to. And at his farewell speech, he's sitting in the room. Reagan comes in, sits at the table. The monitors are up there and they're not on. And he's getting ready to give his farewell address. And all of a sudden, the monitors come on. And the picture on the monitor is Ronald Reagan. And he looks up and he says, oh, there he is. And that's such a great story because that's what Ronald Reagan was to the country, mm-hmm. was what was on that
that's
television
right.
screen, yeah. not what was in that room.
Masterful mm-hmm. with the media. I was fascinated in the book. We're talking with Susan Swain and Brian Lamb about the presidents. Everyone should go out and get this book.
Absolutely.
And this is
it's
a
such
great,
an education.
Great gift. We already did graduation gifts, but this is great gift.
This is everybody's gift. This is an everybody gift.
Lincoln really understood and appreciated the media, and he cared deeply about his image. He grows the beard. He wants to make sure everybody's painting him, taking his photograph, these kinds of things. How would Lincoln do in today's modern age world of media?
Who knows, really? I mean, it's so hard to project that.
He would be offended by it, but...
Probably. But he really cared so much about his image, I think, that he adapted to photography mm-hmm. coming in when he was in office. So I think he would adapt and use, yeah. which all successful politicians do. You know, my favorite story in the Lincoln chapter, we chose Harold Holzer, fabulous Lincoln scholar. How many books? 48 has he written?
52.
Oh, wow.
Good
about
Lord.
Lincoln. Can you imagine?
Mark, get going.
Plumbing the depths of Abraham Lincoln again and again. But this one is the time between his election and when he arrives for the inaugural. Mm-hmm. And I'm so taken by, Jeannie, you talk about the personal stories. He had to give away the family dog in Springfield, Illinois,
yes.
and he sold all the rest of his possessions because he knew he was never coming back again. And he couldn't bear to sell the dog, so he gave it to someone. Mm-hmm. And we had no money for our presidents to travel from their home.
Right.
So all of that was at his own expense, and then he had a threat against his life as he was doing it. So you really feel the personal part of this as you're mm-hmm. reading this with the historians.
But he wrote a lot. Mm-hmm. He would write a lot. I'm willing to bet he wouldn't quite be the Twitter monster that
probably
some
not.
Of us know. But I have a feeling he would adapt pretty well.
He'd have a lot of trouble with television. Mm. He had a high-pitched voice.
Which is so not what you would think, looking
right.
at him.
No, right.
I mean, he looks today this icon with the beard and everything else.
The chiseled face.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, they're often made as they go along. And then again, the saddest mm-hmm. thing about four of them is they were assassinated.
Right.
Yeah.
And
although two of them don't have the notoriety that the other
and McKinley,
two,
yeah. Right?
Yeah.
The Garfield story, by the way, he was one of the greatest talents that ever was elected. He could, you know, he was ambidextrous, could write with both hands. He,
wow.
You know, he knew Greek and Latin and all that. And that story alone, that's a very interesting story. He was elected in the convention on the 36th ballot and wasn't supposed to even be the nominee. I mean, it's just a whole different world.
Right.
Right.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get you both out on this one. Your favorite and your least favorite president. Susan first, then Brian.
Oh, we're not supposed to answer that. That's the C-SPAN thing that goes.
Here you
way
go, ranking all of them. Okay, who has surprised you the most?
I really love the James K. Polk story, written by Siegenthaler, mm-hmm. Who was a fabulous journalist mm-hmm. and one of the creators of USA Today. And he came in saying, I'm going to do one term. I'm going to pass these four things.
And
he got them done.
Mm-hmm.
But you talk about writing. He was a really angry man. And he would go back to the White House every night and rail against everybody in Washington in his diary.
Including people in his own world,
yes.
his own cabinet. And,
oh,
I, just the Polk surgery was
eye-opening
for me. I
just once you read that, you'll never forget
Go to that chapter, yes.
Well, also the Grover Cleveland surgery. Grover Cleveland.
Gene, if you haven't read it, you must.
mouth cancer, and it was never known by the public until after his death in 1917. But they operated on him on a yacht off the coast of Manhattan, and they didn't get it the first time, and they had to go back in and do it again.
Oh.
Now, this is going to sound really crazy to you, but on purpose, I went to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, where the tumor is in a jar.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's the strangest presidential habits.
It's enormous.
What, the size of a peach, size of a baseball? Come on, now that you've taken us down this path.
Probably a size of,
of your fist.
The rest of a fist. And then they put a rubber prosthetic in his mouth. Mm-hmm. But they never, they got away with never telling the public that he had
his wife and his doctors were complicit.
It was amazing how many presidents had serious ailments and problems that we didn't know about.
Yeah. But Jeannie, here's the capper on Brian's story. Capper on Brian's story is that he was photographed the next morning after the surgery sitting on the presidential yacht smoking a cigar.
Nice. Very nice.
Aren't these fascinating characters?
That is unbelievable. Yeah.
Come on, who impressed you the most? Who surprised you the most based on this book and this survey? Who impressed you the most?
I don't know.
Your opinion the most?
I don't know that anybody in particular. I was fortunate to have the Johnson experience and being around the rest of them. And being around them or interviewing them is no way. You cannot say after that you know them. It's just a short time.
You know how little you know.
I would say in this book, one of the most interesting people, and he doesn't have an image of being interesting, and I'm not sure if it's Richard Norton Smith that makes him interesting or whether he really was as interesting as he said, but Hoover. Hoover gets a bad rap for, he did a tremendous amount of humanitarian work that he never gets any credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I ever realized that was doing an interview with David Kennedy, the Stanford, very interesting Stanford historian, where he wrote a book with Hoover first and then FDR. But Richard Norton Smith in this book tells a great story about Hoover and his involvement in Brussels and saving people and things like that. But he didn't have any charisma.
One of the chapters that is really fascinating, and you wouldn't expect it to be, William Howard Taft. Jeff Rosen at the Constitution Center did that interview. It was painful to cut out any of it because every story was so interesting that he told. Not very successful as president, but after the presidency, when he became Chief Justice,
and
a very distinguished record, and he served with people that he appointed.
Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting little fact that helps you understand Ronald Reagan, and it's not in the book, but it was something that I learned in the process of, we did a series on presidents. Ronald Reagan spent 364 days at his ranch during his presidency. Now, that's a year.
Mm-hmm.
With Nancy. That's it. And there's 1,500 square feet that they lived in. And you can go up there. I mean, we were able to go up there after he was president. And, of course, they sold it off to the Young Americans for freedom. But that tells a huge story. And they had very few visitors.
Right.
Here's the other thing to keep in mind is that they were in this little 1,500 square foot lodge, just Nancy up there with him, and 60 Secret Service.
Jeez. Yeah.
I'm sure you've been up there, but it's, you know, and just that, when you just think about that, that he was able for 1 year to live in that solitude and not need anybody else other than his wife.
Right. And a chainsaw.
And his Secret Service buddies, and that one of them was a...
Who adored him.
California highway policeman who would come in and they would build walls together with, you know, bricks and all that. I mean, he'd always, and chop wood.
Yeah.
And ride horses.
Nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. So what's the next big C-SPAN production?
We're going to shut it down.
Enough's enough, right?
We've heard it here.
What are you going to do next, Sarah? She's the boss.
Our next production is a little presidential election.
Just a wee little thing?
Oh, yeah. Just a little that ought to keep you busy. Yeah.
How would you recommend? Okay, really, last question. So there's a debate or debates Thursday and Friday. It's a two-day extravaganza. Debate palooza or whatever.
Right.
What is your advice to the average person out there who wants to learn? How should they watch those? What should they be looking for? What should they be listening for? Susan, you have to go first and let Brian finish us out.
I think, actually, we've been telling people all along, these 10 metrics are an interesting thing as the year goes by.
That's a great idea.
To assess the candidates against these leadership qualities.
Very good idea.
Because you're not looking for how well they do on the issue of the day that someone throws at them, but really, what do they bring to the table, what kind of experience they bear, and how do they think about some of the things that the historians have devised as a metric for the presidency.
It's a great idea because it's so easy to get so emotional. But give people, here are some real deal things you can look at and use these and then take some of the emotion out of it. Brian, what advice do you have?
I'll tell you what I will do. I will not watch the debates. Mm-hmm. And then the next morning I will spend a lot of time, should even get a notebook out, and listen to the chatter on every, expression. We're the chatter
you right can now. Use that expression.
Listen to the chatter on every network because millions more will hear the chatter then we'll watch the debate.
That's right. It's like the Mueller report.
And by now, we have covered these folks so many hours. Just this last weekend, the Planned Parenthood meeting down in South Carolina, we were not allowed to cover the convention that was exclusive to MSNBC, which is the strangest thing I've ever seen. But I've heard them all. I've read all the stuff. I kind of know where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And then the real thing to do is hear. Turn into Fox, turn into MSNBC, turn into CNN, listen to podcasts, listen to what other people are saying, and then you'll get a better idea of what kind of a message is getting out there.
Have you both read the Mueller report?
Yes.
No.
What'd you think, Susan?
Well, I think everyone should read it, absolutely.
Yes. Because I got halfway through on my trip to Sweden and Copenhagen back.
The second half is a lot easier to read than the first half, for sure. I wanted to say one closing thought, if I could, about this book, though, because you all love
the president.
So much.
Thank you, Susan Swain, Brian Lamb.
This is not our book. This is a compendium of 43 of the best contemporary presidential biographers. Mm-hmm. So the people that are listening to this love books. So any one of these chapters is just an entry point for the work of these historians. And if you love it, you can go find more that they've done. And that's what we're hoping people will do.
Yeah. One of the great things about it, Jeannie and I were talking about this, you can pick it up, you can read a chapter, put it down, the next day pick it up, another chapter. I sat there with the book and my phone in my hand because I'd read something, I want to know more about that.
Mm-hmm,
so I go to my best friend Google.
We have a website devoted to exactly what you are doing. You don't need to do our website, but it's set up so that you can click on a lot of the different the acts that were passed or whatever, the different events. But you're right. I do the same thing. You sit there with your Google and just go back yourself up all the time with everything you read.
Yeah, sure.
It makes it a lot more interesting.
So it's the president's. It's amazing. Susan Swain, Brian Lamb, thank you.
Thank you
for
being
with
us.
Tori, you're amazing.
We love Tori Clark.
Put that in the loop. So we are going to take a break. You guys have to just bear with us here for a second. So we're going to go from the sublime to the ridiculous and come back with Deserted Island. Right, Mark?
That's right.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Lovely.
I don't think Susan and Brian can hear our island music, but we're back. and I was remiss. I need to ask Susan because we do have our lovely wine from Calvert Woodley. And if you go there and say Chatter 5, you get $5 off your bill. And this is from Barbersville. Susan, go.
I have one factoid, and that is the first Reagan-Gorbachev summit Barbersville wine was chosen to serve to Mr. Gorbachev.
Here you go.
That's pretty spectacular. I am thinking, though, it was not, the wine could not have been so great at the time.
It was only a few years after they started.
Very romantic, though. Okay, so it's Deserted Island. In the summertime, I really wanted to do this for Michael Kornheiser, who could not be with us this evening. But
who is an expectant parent.
Yes, is an expectant parent. Mm-hmm. And so most babies are born in the summer, most in August, interestingly enough, occasionally June and July, but mostly in August. So, David, we'll go to you first. Book for expectant parents.
I outsource this to the person who's had given birth to my two children.
Always a good idea.
And she says, if it's any help, I would say your favorite escape from it all author genre, because you won't have the time or energy to read for pleasure again for a while.
That's good.
Yeah.
I like that. Jeannie?
Well, I'm with Diane, David's wife. I have never been pregnant. I'm a step-parent, so I've parented. But it seems to me that pregnant women are always vulnerable to unwanted advice, to people just observing that they're pregnant and walking up to them and giving mm-hmm. advice or putting their hands all over them or whatever. And so I would say exactly that. Sometimes too much knowledge is a dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. So don't read too many of these books. Read something that you've always wanted to read, that you've never had the time to read.
Right.
Because once that baby is born,
it's over.
Not, yeah. It's over.
Yeah.
It's over.
You won't read for 25 years. Right. Mark?
You seriously want to get my intake?
Absolutely. We want diversity of opinions.
I don't have
opinions.
Any children. I will never have any children.
As far as you know.
Well, I wouldn't give a book. I would give alcohol, you know? So, you know, if I were going to give a book, I would go in the vein of, like, escapism. Mm-hmm. And now I don't, this would just be what I would want to read. I would read Douglas Adams, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
There you go.
Because it just sort of takes you off.
You know, the Bible in this category is What to Expect When You're Expecting.
I know, but you said we can do that.
10 billion copies of that freaking book sold. So I used to fill in with Mary Madeline and her show, Equal Time. Remember that show?
I do.
Talking about cable. That was the essence of cable. And we would have authors on because it was a lot more fun than talking to stupid politicians. And so at one point in the season, she and I were both pregnant, and our friends, who clearly were not our friends, would let us show up on that show pregnant wearing plaid dresses.
Oh.
Plaid.
Oh.
Never a good choice. Really not a good choice when you're pregnant. And we had the author on. I can't remember her name. But if you've seen this book, and I think they've improved the cover, we were always struck by, again, it was the Bible, and millions of people had it. And the cover showed this really sad-looking woman sitting there, just sad. Sad face, sad hair, sad everything. And we just thought, oh, it was just some horrible artist rendition. And then the author showed up, and that was her. And that is exactly what we thought when she's on the show, she'll brighten up and we'll get into the joy. Nope. There was nothing funny about it.
There was no joy.
There was no joy in the expectations. So the best book anybody ever gave me was Annie Lamott, Operating Instructions. And it was really about the first 2 years of her son's life. It is absolutely spectacular. And that's a really good one and a really funny one. So this has been a terrific show. We are going to come back next week with Angie Kim and this book, Miracle Creek. And I'm telling people, if you've not read this book or heard about this book, go get it.
Right.
It is remarkable. It's fiction. C-SPAN friends, hang in there. But really, really remarkable person, incredible life herself. And she wrote this book. And one of the most interesting things about it is, if you read the New York Times review, you think it is about parents and their hopes for children. If you read the Washington Post review, you think it's a murder mystery. If you read somebody else's review, she brings so many things into this book. And I read it, and then I listened to it on the plane coming home from Sweden the other day, and I never stopped. 8 hours. Never stopped listening to this book. So it's great, and we'll be back. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Take care.